Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes podcast show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at my blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com, or you are in the most efficient way to get the show. You are on iTunes. Go into iTunes, go into the search engine. All you have to do is put Lord Gaul, which was my username when I fell in love with kickboxing, K1 fans, Kakatugi, K1 USA, all the forums that used to post as Lord Gaul. And the other efficient way, of course, is just to enter the Warman Kickfighting Show, and my podcast pops right up. Been excited about this show for a while, and I'm going to bring it to you every single week because last year I failed you. Last year I was going to have a summer series. I think I did one episode of the summer series and then didn't get into it for the rest of the summer, got involved. I still kept bringing you shows. I just kept didn't bring you the series like I said I was, just revisiting some of the greater events of kickboxing and so on. So I am going to do it every single week in the month of August. So we might even spill over in September, but go ahead and expect me to do something from the summer series outside of just what's happening in the kickboxing world. So today I'm going to be talking about some of the bigger upsets that's always happened. Not all of these upsets they're not every upset. First of all, I'm really staying in the internet era. I mentioned that before. So a lot of this stuff will be kind of from 1997 up to now. I'm kind of staying in that gap. There are upsets that happened before, and I don't want to discount those upsets, but I'm really going to focus on the internet era of great upsets in, you know, Muay Thai and kickboxing. I'll have my criteria for it when I come back to you guys, but I'll go ahead and jump into this right away. First, I want to talk about some results that we had here, and I'll go ahead and start with an upset. So one of the top women in the world loses after dominating a fight. Gong Yan Li gets a KO of the year type candidate, spinning back fist of Jemima Betrayne literally at the bell. At the bell as much as possible. Like, it's just, you know, Jemima's winning the whole fight. Then there's like a teep. And there's like a separation. The ref pulls me. I can't remember exactly what the separation was. But after that separation, with literally no time on the clock almost, Gong steps up, does a spinning back fist. Jemima looks like she was doing something. She's walking forward, looking for big offense. Jemima's been hit and dropped before. Like Tiffany Von Seuss caught her with a spinning back fist. She was Wang Qihan, who she is really, really good friends with, also dropped her early in the fight. Jemima is so used to being the stronger, superior athlete that sometimes she just, you know, walks through people's offense. So she just expects that if she gets hit, it's just not going to matter. This was just the right kind of shot, the right kind of time. And as they say, the shot that knocks you out is the one you don't see. And I don't think she saw that spinning back fist coming. When she saw the spin happen before her, I don't even know if she thought that she was in range to get hit by. And it's not like Gong had extended her hand for it. Gong landed the spinning back fist pretty tight. Like, it's her spin, is the rotation's pretty tight. There's not a long swinging arm, like for those of you who watched the Yair Rodriguez fight in MMA last night. Some of his spinning back fist, his whole body's like twirling, like you know, his arms are out like a, you know, amusement park ride. This is not an amusement park ride type shot. This is her whole rotation is pretty tight. She just lands right shot. Jemima Betrayne goes down. Clearly, Jemima's one of the best fighters in the world. She will drop in my rankings, of course, because if you lose, you drop. But, like, it's weird because this is her first fight in a long time. You know, she had some fights fall through when she was supposed to be fighting MMA as well. And she'll bounce back, and China will use her again. She's an entertaining fighter. But big-time win for Gong Yan Li. Clearly the upset of the year in kickboxing. A couple other results from that card. I won't go through the whole card. First, we got to talk about Cedric Dombe. So he gets a first-round victory over Shane Yoe. It's one of those things where Yoe was probably, you know, down to fight. And then after things started not going his way, he was not down to fight. He was spinning around and just, like, Cedric Dombe went after the first down. Really, a lot of the down just kind of came just because of Yoe's, you know, body language. He just wasn't there. The final shot was a legit shot. That, you know, I believe his right hand, if I remember correctly, that put Yoe down and down for good. But just sometimes you go in there and you've got a plan, and, you know, not to be, you know, I take no shame in saying, you know, Mike Tyson, everybody's got a plan until they get hit. Sometimes your confidence goes away so quickly by the skill level of the person you're going against. Sometimes it happens before you get in there, but sometimes it can happen with one big shot, or it can happen by you trying something and you just realize, None of this stuff is going to work. This guy's way too good. So definitely be conscious of that. for, athletes who are listening to this podcast who also start to fight, get your mental game going. Very, very important. Even hit up Vinny Shorman if you feel like you're lacking in the mental game. Vinny Shorman will get his mind coach on you. But ideally, when you go in there, you cannot have what happened to your way, because not only did he go down mentally, he just shut down. And that meant after Cedric kept going looking for the stoppage, he didn't have any resistance. He just kind of moved away until it was over with. As for Cedric Dombey, who had a very competitive fight when he fought in Glory, he is a talented guy. I think that he, 8-1, had a spectacular victory early in the year. I think Mirtha Grinhart, if I remember correctly. I apologize if that's wrong. But he's got a lot of tools, and he really can be someone that moving forward, we see for quite a long time in this weight division. 88 kgs just means that he's fighting, he didn't have that much of a cut. He had to do 77 kgs for Glory, and I really do believe that that's where his home's going to be. There's all kinds of great fights out, especially if he's fighting in China. We can always bring up the fact that he could fight Artur Kashenko, who's out there, putting in work and on those, on that level of the Chinese fight cards that keep using him. He's out there putting in good work. Dombey could end up fighting him. Nicky Holtzkin still in the possibility. Like I said, that, no shame. I believe his two Glory fights was a loss to Johan Gungulu, close, and then the victory over Mirtha Grinhart. So I think that, if I look at him, I look at his skill set, I really do think that he is the type of fighter that could be known in this weight class for the next 4 years. He's very, very talented. Hopefully you see more from Cedric Dombey. Definitely pay attention to the Frenchman. It was going to happen eventually. France has got a solid history of high-level kickboxing and Muay Thai. They've got, we've got, we can go back to, your Danny Bills. We can go from, Danny Bills to Farid Valooms, who is like one of my favorite Farid Valooms. There are so many talented, Kamel Jamel. There's a lot of, Samir Muhammad. They've got a huge history of kickboxing. So definitely want to make sure that we get those athletes the recognition they deserve. And with Glory going to France, it seems like at least once a year, he should have more opportunities. Also going to talk about Israel Adesanya. My favorite thing about Israel Adesanya, of course, coming off of his, after he got the win back over Philip Verlinden. Adesanya, who fights both in MMA and kickboxing, I love how active he is. It's so important. People don't pay attention to it enough in this game, but he fights as much as he can. He fights all the time, I feel like once a month I'm saying, oh, this is who Israel Adesanya is fighting now. And it's so huge because he's got such internet buzz. People in, mixed martial arts communities, they know about him because really he's so mean in the clinch. And again, he's going against inferior opposition in MMA as it stands. Guys that he is clearly a superior fighter. Kickboxing, he's been the superior fighter in a lot of them, but there's also some really good push against him. I don't know what his contract status is. I don't know if he is left free because he's, going to for sure be someone, who fights in the UFC. I don't know if there's – I saw somebody saying something language-wise that looked like it could possibly be what was going to happen. But, man, Israel Adesanya is the truth. And he's all action, entertaining guy who – I'm hoping. I remember when Glory didn't use him again right away. People were like, what's going on there? What's going on with that? This guy's out there clearly killing it. And it's the weight class that you're using the most because, Joe Schilling and Artem Levin and, the tournament they put together, that weight class around 85 kgs is the one that they've been focusing on the most. So I was so surprised that they didn't use him on a regular basis. But their promotion, they do what they want to do. But I do think that there are some talented guys that will add to their already talented field and really put on some entertaining bouts. I'll go ahead and, there are other fights on this card. The Wiru victory over Matteo Ticini. Go ahead and bring that up. I believe it's Tuccini. And then the last one I wanted to talk about is Zhang Akayan, his victory over Soyak Pumpung Mang. Soyak, of course, is a longtime international competitor. This is at 72 kg, so Soyak is already a little bit small for the weight class. Like a lot of Thais who fight internationally, they're usually the smaller people. You know, of those the two competitors, they're usually the smaller. Bukau, for example, he never had to cut weight when he was the best in the world, when he was killing people over in K1 Max. He never was the biggest guy, or he was never the superior guy as far as, you know, physical strength on fight day. He was always the same weight. He never really had to, you know, do a lot of cutting for, you know, 70 kgs like guys like, you know, Albert Krauss or Jaume Parr, who were bigger for the weight class. Krauss wasn't necessarily big. Jaume Parr was big for the weight class. So he didn't have to cut like those guys. He just kind of had to chill, you know, stay around that weight class. In that way, Soyak, you know, had a lot of international opportunities, and he fought some really good guys. He's got some really good wins. They brought him out to, you know, Holland several times for their slam event when they go Holland versus Thailand. So this is a big win for Zhang Keyin. For me, it's always about building on it, you know, because when you get these upset wins, and China has got, the kickboxing is growing. These, you know, these are regular TV shows that I'm talking about for their brand. They get the opportunity, thanks to the TV deals, to keep putting on fights and international opportunities, so their fighters are going to be able to grow. Who has the best chance of catching some of those countries in Europe, like Holland and so on, as far as producing elite stars on a regular basis? China does, because they have the venues. They say, hey, grow up, we'll get you the fights, we'll get you on TV. They have the ways to move you, and the way Japan had the way to move their local athletes, China has the same. So Zhang Keyin, it's a good win. Not as big as it was. A win over Soyak was definitely much bigger, you know, 3-4 years ago. But still, a win is a win over an elite Thai who's got international competition. What do you do from here? Very, very important. We'll go ahead and move into the next card that we're going to talk about. And there were some news and note things that I was thinking about bringing up. I'll go ahead and skip them, like I said. None of them were significant. None of them that weren't things that I can't bring up on later date. You know, Xavier Vinny versus Ty Lewis Perry. That, of course, is, you know, a rematch, but that was set for Glory going on in New Jersey in September. You know, I've mentioned that one before. Let me see. W5. That's down the road, so don't necessarily need to jump on that too much, but I am happy that W5's back. Got some good fights on that card. Yeah, I'll go ahead and just move on to one more fight card, and then go ahead and get us on to my big show, my summer series. Kunlun had a show last night. I got to catch a couple of the clips. I wasn't able to watch all the full fights, but I did get a good percentage of them. Go ahead and get into it. First of all, let's mention Danilo Zanellini gets a victory over Gu Hui, 30-27, 29-28, and 29-28 twice. Danilo is a guy who actually had the opportunity, if I'm remembering correctly, to fight in Max. And he didn't fight too bad, but he just wasn't used again. And he's on a long list of guys like Murat Dureci, guys who were used once and then never really used, you know, for whatever reason, weren't brought back. But he's always been a skilled fighter. He's a decent name to have on your resume internationally. Not great name, but decent name. Glad that he got this win. Consistency will have to happen. And for him, he needs to just, even if some of them are a little bit older, you know, like Albert Krauss, who we're going to talk about in a little bit, he's got to go out there and try to get some of those wins. He really does. He's got to go out there and try to fight some elite guys who've got names. Win, lose, or draw, he's got to put himself out there, because I feel like his career is going to pass by without him ever being in what I would call a significant fight. So he needs to go ahead and find a Andy Risty type, or, you know, Robin van Roosmalen's at the top, but, you know, some sort of name, you know, better than what he's been facing. But go ahead and give him the win over Gu Hui. Petring Nong gets a victory over Tetsuya Yamada, 30-28, 29-28, and 29-28. It was a tournament qualifier. First of all, shout out to them. This Kunlun event took place in Japan, and it's important for the growth of their brand if their TV show, which is, I don't necessarily need them to come to America. What I mean by that is, if they are a TV show, they've got to be in places where their broadcast lines up with the hours that people are going to be watching it in China. So I'm good with them going to Australia. I'm good with them going to Japan. I'm good with them being in areas where they don't have that much of a, you know, deviance from the time schedule that they're used to being on TV. But it does mean something to traveling fighters that they get the opportunity to fight, and, you know, maybe they can't come to your country, or maybe you train in a certain area. Maybe you're training in Thailand and Kuen Lun goes down there. That's huge. So definitely shout out to them for bringing this card. Tetsuya Yamada is one of the best fighters in the world in, you know, Muay Thai International. Kickboxing, he's always been solid. He gets good wins and he gets good losses. Like, he's a guy who has two victories over Kevin Ross. He's a guy who's got a head kick loss to Senchai. He's just a veteran Muay Thai fighter who kickboxes occasionally. And he ran into Pech Tun Nong, who is a superior in kickboxing and Muay Thai today. Just a superior athlete. Doesn't have the name of some of the other international ties, but shout out to him for getting this victory. I'm going to go ahead and move on in the card. Tenshin Nasukawa gets a victory over Chaelin Bin, TKO in the first round, and, I mean, he put it on him. Big win for Tenshin. This is what I'm talking about. Tenshin, and I'm going to talk about it with Hinata in a little bit. Tenshin Nasukawa. Nasukawa really did a good job of getting his hands on him, getting Ben out of there, which you can do. Ben's got a history. He's hittable, you know, and he's been in some fun fights, but he's also been stopped as recently as Mustafa Mirai. He's another guy who stopped him. But this guy is, Nasukawa is, after this win, it's kind of how you build on it. And there's been a history of Lakanato, who he had a big win back in the day. I want to say it was Mike Zambides. And again, it was another big win over Artur Kashchenko, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. But it just goes to show that these wins sit in space if you don't build on them. So Nasukawa's got to now go out there, maybe get himself on, you know, some Rise card or some, you know, Crush card in Japan. And he's got to ask for a step-up international bout. He needs to build on this. He can't do this and then go back to fighting on, you know, just some local guys. He's got to try to build. Glory is a little bit tougher because Glory is, you know, as it's starting to look, Glory doesn't use too many fighters from the Asian markets. The Asian talent pools, of course, have got a lot of talented guys. But outside of Sitichai, you know, and Sanchai from Thailand, I don't really see guys from China. I don't really see guys from Japan. Don't really see guys from Australia used on a regular basis. It could be happenstance, but I don't see it as much, and I would like to see it more. I'm going to go ahead and slide down this card a little bit more. I'll leave those alone. I'll go ahead and get to the meat of it. The last two, Craig Dixon gets a victory over Bai Lishui. I bring up Craig Dixon because he is an English fighter who's got, again, a lot of international experience. Muay Thai is where I know him from, and I'm just glad that he was able to get this victory here. I do not know how his skill set holds up for for kickboxing long term, but I was glad that he got this win. It's definitely good to build on. And then the main fight of this card, as far as those who are, you know, see names internationally that they recognize, would be Hinata Watanabe getting the victory over Albert Krauss. Albert Krauss is old now. He's older. And he's definitely trying. And the pop that he used to have in his hands, once upon a time when Albert Krauss let them hands go, you didn't know what to think. Like, you were stuck. You were lost in the kind of back and forth that you thought that you could be in exchanges with. And the next thing you know, his hands just kept coming and you pretty much get blown out of the water. Perfect example, Albert Krauss, when he first went against Andy Sauer, scored something big, and I swear Albert Krauss threw like 7,000 punches in that 1 minute round, and he stops it at the end of the first round. You can't beat such offensive, volume, and then the legitimate pop, not necessarily huge KO pop, but a legitimate crack in, Albert Krauss. That's who he used to be. But he won the K-1 World Grand Prix, the first K-1 Max World Grand Prix in 2002, and it is 2016 right now. So we are talking 14 years since that great day for him. He's had a lot of wins, had a lot of great international opportunities, had a lot of controversies, had a lot of KOs. He just had a fun career. And as he winds it down, he's still getting these opportunities in China and so on, who are paying him solid money to be a kickfighter still. Hinata is a could have been. Hinata, definitely one of the guys who I, when Masato fought, there was always this big who's going to follow Masato. And there were a lot of failures. I would say back in the day, I think I was most high on Yoshihiro Sato because he fought on the Super League before. So I was familiar with him, but I knew that he just didn't. He had an interesting style that was more suited for Muay Thai. And he had the volume. He just didn't have the pop behind it a lot of times. He got better at pop, you know, in the way that Rin Bojanski started to punch better. He was able to punch better once he got a hold of, okay, for scorecards, I'm going to have to sit in these shots a little bit better. So shout out to him for that. But, man, it needs to be said that it really, he did an okay job. At least he got to turn the final. Sato did. Yu Yamamoto, he maybe got past the first round of some tournaments, got past the quarters, but never really anything after that. Hinata, I thought, had one of the better skill sets. He's got a really good, one of the meanest body kicks in the game. And George Petrosian once said the hardest kicker he ever fought was Hinata. His body kick doesn't come wide. It comes in and sharp. It comes up from the ground and comes straight towards you. It's almost like a direct line. There's not a lot of wide to it. There's not, like, if you see a perfect example, the power left kick of Yotsenkai, it comes powerful, but it also comes wide because he's so big and strong, you know, for the weight class. It comes wide and powerful. Hinata's doesn't come like that at all. It shoots up from where it's sitting and it stands, and it comes right at your rib. And there were some times where he hit Kraus with some really good shots that just echoed. So Hinata gets this win. What it does for Hinata, I have no clue. He could win this one and then turn around and just lose the next two, you know, and lose the next three. He's a skilled guy, but he's got to build on it. So this is just an opportunity. Hopefully he fights again in another month and a half, 2 months. But he's got to build on it, and he is a name that Glory should consider bringing back. His outings in Glory weren't that great, but then again, he went against a tough guy. You know, he had, you know, the one body kick victory, and then he had a KO stoppage, I want to say, was that Andy Risty? Yeah, I want to say it was Andy Risty. But Hinata still a name to be, you know, be paying attention to in kickboxing. Still a lot of skill, and I would like to see him on the international level for sure. I will now get into my summer series. You know, just go ahead, take a quick second, go over my notes real quick. It's a lot of fun putting this together. I'll say in advance, one thing that comes into play for me is the cleaner the victory, the easier it was for me to put it down. So, for example, there are some upsets that happen that have a lot of controversy around them, so I didn't have them make the list. Jiang Weipar versus Yotsenkai 3, for example, was a fight that a lot of people felt Yotsenkai won, you know, actually pretty clear, you know. Most had it 4-1, giving Jiang Weipar that last round. It's a tough one, but I was like, man, I can't put that on the list because of so much. I just remember when it popped up that a lot of people talked about it. They were disappointed in the decision. They felt it was a hometown decision. It just did happen that way. So I'll go ahead and leave that one alone. There were a couple other fights that had decisions that made you, you know, another good example of a, you know, Westerner over a tie. In this example too, San Chai, you know, had a, I guess, you know, it was definitely controversial because, again, I thought Sanchai had won the fight clear. But, sorry, I'm not sure if you guys noticed that there was a slight glitch in my recording. Sorry about that. Anyways, what I was saying was another victory they really wanted to have added to the list. And part of me is leaning towards adding to it. So go ahead and just add to it. I do think that this is, I thought the cards were not, for me personally, I didn't think that they were clean. You know, I thought that, you know, Kong Hongjing's victory over, you know, Sanchai is a weird, weird kind of victory. I wasn't, you know, it was extra round split decision that went his way. I definitely felt there was some controversy in that one. I don't know if I feel as confident putting that one on the list as much as I will put the Fabio Pinca victory over over Sanchai in the list. Again, I just felt like Sanchai was, you know, he was still playing the game. I still thought that he was probably doing a bit better job of outscoring. But if you look at his resume, if you were to go to his Wikipedia right now and see how dominant, you know, Sanchai has been, and this is going against a lot of international competition at a really high level. Clearly, you've got some losses to, you know, Pechpunchu and stuff like that in the major stadiums. Definitely want to give due to those who, but those are, like, to me, guys his peers. So he just lost guys. I mean, even though he beat Pechpunchu in the past, those are his peers. Singdam, Pechpunchu, those are his peers. Internationally, he'd been doing work. And I looked at that and I go, you know what? I have to really rank that victory by Fabio Pinca higher. So that'll be my first entry. Fabio Pinca beating Sanchai. Fabio Pinca is an awesome fighter. He is the first Thai fight champion back when Thai fight was actually going to be a really awesome thing when they put together this huge international field of like 32 guys and went down to 16 guys and the eight. It was great in the beginning. The idea of Thai fight in the beginning was awesome, and Fabio Pinca was the first champion. Then one day it just turned into TV ratings and you know, large crowds where you watched, where everybody showed up and watched the outside venue of some superior Thai going against some guy who just traveled to Thailand and just get, you know, stopped on TV, you know, by the local champions. That to me wasn't the best. You know, that was not their best effort. Their beginning effort had this huge tournament field. Liam Harrison was in that tournament field. It really was entertaining. So it's not that Pinca was a nobody, but when he got this win, and if you look at who Sanchai has beaten, you know, and you look at his international run, he really is a talented dude, and he really had some very entertaining fights, beat a lot of the best fighters in a lot of different countries, so I had to, even though I was at a bigger weight, had to give Fabio Pinca his love for that upset victory. It really, really was good stuff. Going to go ahead and go back through the field, as I mentioned before. Most of these are going to be in the millennial area, or excuse me, I shouldn't say millennials area, or I'll say the internet era for the most part. So, going to go ahead and go with one of the bigger ones, Bob Sepp. Two victories over Ernesto Hoost. Again, this one I was torn on because of illegal tactics and reffing, because clearly there was a lot of times where Bob Sapp almost did what was the equivalent of a stiff arm and pushed Ernesto Hoost over into the corner because he couldn't get him there. And then he started doing these clubbing shots to the back of the head. The second fight, he for sure landed a, you know, after he was, you know, getting destroyed. Like Ernesto Hoost came out, low kick game on point, body punching on point, dropped Bob Sapp. Bob could have quit there. Bob got back up. It's so crazy to see how Bob's career winded down when you look at how Bob came into play. First of all, he was the truest definition of what Freak Show was supposed to be in Japan. He basically, Bob Sapp burst on the scene because he was, and again, I'll talk about his story a little bit later, but he did, you know, a tough man fight, won a tough man fight. Somebody from Japan saw his build because he's, you know, for a guy that big to have, you know, a six pack, it's just, you know, pretty much unheard of. And they, you know, brought him in to, you know, somebody, you know, called him about his opportunities in Japan, flew him out. Got him a fight, did a lot of illegal tactics in that first fight, and then after, you know, teaching him a little bit of what to do, they had a huge draw, Japanese TV-wise, for this awesome, awesome specimen of a guy, and he went out there and he got two victories over one of the true greats of all time. And you got to give him his due, because I remember I saw something on ESPN, of all things, where they were talking about him, and then I remember the reporter says, but you lost to him twice. And then he said, yeah, you know, because they were interviewing Ernesto Hoost, because Ernesto Hoost hated the idea of Bob Sapp in the beginning, because he's right. If you're a sportsman at all, you've got to be offended that there are people all over the world, because back then there were these tournament fields. You had to win the map to get into K1 World Grand Prix. Used to be, you got to win your region. You win your region, that got you a spot at, you know, winning your country, you know, or winning, you know, the Grand Prix for representative for your country to get into the European Grand Prix. So that's, we're talking two tournaments already, so that's eight fights. You get into that Grand Prix, you win that Grand Prix, now you can go over to Japan. So you've got 12 fights just to get yourself in that position. So Eigenshaw, for example, he had to win a regional, and then he had to win the K1 World Grand Prix over in, it was in France that year, so that'd be eight fights for him. Some people, it's a little bit more. Then he goes over to Japan, and even before the elimination, he fought in some single fight as like an introduction, and then he goes into the elimination field. So we're talking 10 fights before the K1 World Grand Prix, And then the K1 World Grand Prix is 3 fights in 1 night. Excuse me. And it depends on those tournament fields. Some of those tournament fields are 16. Some of those are 4. Some of those are 8. So let me not discount that. So they could have been 3. So I think for Ignashov, it was 3 for regional, 3 for the K1 Europe Grand Prix, 1 single fight, 1 elimination fight to get into the tournament field. And then in the tournament field, you got another 3 fights. But there was a map to how you got there. Bob Sapp skips all the maps. He shows up. They just put him in there because he's a freak show guy. Go in there, show the crowd, you know, row, growl, all that kind of stuff. And then here goes Ernesto Hoost. And he came in, and there were some clubbing shots. There were some shots to the back of the head. There were some clearly illegal pushing antics like that for sure. And despite it all, Sapp never showed any signs of, like, stopping because of being hurt or physically ill. He just got up and he just kept pushing. So for him to end his career the way he ended was people kind of getting on him about not fighting and just showing up and taking paychecks. It was not that way in the beginning. It really wasn't. Ernesto Hoost put him down with a body shot. He got back up. Round 2, they're throwing, and he actually lands probably his best shot against Ernesto Hoost, a clubbing shot that knocked Ernesto Hoost down. And then after it was over with, they started to go back to it, and then literally, as illegal as it is, Bob Sapp comes over and like gathers Hoost up, pushes him in a corner, starts clubbing away. It has to be said, for its place in kickboxing history, Bob Sapp's 2 victories over Ernesto Hoost. You cannot do this list without talking about that. They were huge upsets. They should not have happened. After that, Bob Sapp reality, you know, came into play. Lost to Mirko, lost to, you know, Remy Bonjowski, lost to Ray Seffel, lost to Musashi. And then, of course, it all went downhill after that. He did win a Japanese Grand Prix once upon a time. But in the end, I look at Bob Sapp and I look at his figure. And one of the most interesting characters, you know, and I gotta, if I do a top 10, which I probably will, of interesting characters in, you know, the combat sports or in kickboxing, Muay Thai, he'd definitely be on that list. I'm going to go back into the list, and I'm going to go to a fight that's significant for those who were junkies of kickboxing. There was a league, a kickboxing organization called Super League. And Super League was a, they had more weight classes than K1. And they had credibility because their best fighter at the time had beaten the best fighter in the max. So Kamel Al-Omrani had a victory in the late 90s against Albert Krauss, who went on to be the best, the first champion of the K1 max. So it was a big deal that this organization got that fighter, you know, under their banner. Big deal. And then you go ahead and you go from there and you look at, you know, what he became. You know, he was winning and he had this great style. He had the kickboxing style of the Europeans, but he also had that Taekwondo flash. So at any moment, spinning back fist, axe kick, Kamel Al-Omrani could bring those aspects to the table. Ole Larsen was this guy who flirted with MMA, flirted with kickboxing, flirted with Muay Thai. He just kind of did it all. And he, you know, was one of those guys who was European but really found a base in Thailand and in Asia very, very early. And when these two met, it was supposed to be business as usual. Kamel Al-Omrani was the guy. He was the star for the promotion. He's the guy they most pushed. Victory over John Wei Parr, if I remember correctly. He was the guy. And Ole Larsen stopped him. Like, it was, I'm telling you, it was one of those things where, and the forums, there were a lot of people who were faking it on the forums. And what I mean by that is they act like they knew things after they happened. So when this fight happened, a lot of people were like, I knew Ole Larsen had what it took, that kind of stuff, whatever. I didn't know too much about either of the guys because I just got into kickboxing. So I wasn't on the, you know, I knew it all the time train then. But I was on it later for a couple other fights I'll talk about. But man, it was a amazing, amazing upset at the time because Larsen was, people thought that he wasn't just going to lose, he was going to get schooled. But it was considered the biggest fight for the promotion, probably to this day still the biggest fight for the promotion. Ole Larsen, you know, he had somewhat, a little bit of a name, but he was supposed to lose and he came out and he got that victory. Ole Larsen stopping Kamel Al-Omrani in the early 2000s, definitely for Super League. Definitely their most talked about fight. And they had a lot of great fighters go through there. Yuri Mess fought for them a couple times. Dmitry Shikuta fought for them a couple times. Dmitry Shikuta, who beat, he beat Brown. He beat Yuri Mess. He beat Yuri Mess with a head kick. Dmitry Shikuta was the truth. They had some talented guys there. So shout out to them. Shout out to the, you know, that brand and what it meant, because it really did try to do its best to Cesar Cordoba fought for them once before. They tried to fill the gap between the heavyweight division and, you know, the max division. So they had a lot of different weight classes, but just consistency, and they never ended up being what they could have been, but they were still really cool for what they were. So definitely shout out to them, and shout out to Ole Larsen. That victory was you know, it really was something. I'm going to go ahead and go back to K1 now as we talk about Francisco Filho and his KO victory over Andy Hoog in the first round. One of the key KO punches in the history of kickboxing. You definitely got to give its due for where it stood in its history. Basically, Francisco Filho and Andy Hoog. Andy Hoog got into K1 because of his Kyokushin background. Kyokushin, huge, and it's not as big right now. Right now, I don't know where a Kyokushin gym is here and where I live in Fort Worth, Dallas area in Texas. When I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I grew up, I didn't know of any Kyokushin gyms. I knew of Taekwondo gyms. I knew of all kinds of gyms that had different karate arts. I didn't know at all, of any gym whatsoever that did Kyokushin. It was really something that lived in Japan and a few places in Brazil. So the stars that emerged from that, there were a couple, you know, guys who really, you know, burst on the scene. One of the big ones, of course, was Andy Hoog, and that's what got him into K1. So he didn't have the boxing part down because he was so used to just punching to the chest, but he could, you know, kick a knee to the head, so he had that flair if you gave him space. So Andy Hoog was the first star, struggled early on, ended up becoming one of the better fighters in K1 down the road. Of course, he got the spinning, you know, back heel kick, low kick for his K1 World Grand Prix, a epic moment in the history of kickboxing, and something that I'll have to bring up later on one of the shows. He then goes on to win the K1 World Grand Prix. He is the champion of the world. What do they do with the champion? They want to put the champion against what would be kind of a special fight. Now, I think he'd fought like once or twice after he won the K1 World Grand Prix. But enter Francisco Filho. If I'm remembering this correctly, the actual Kumite is this grueling 100-like fighter, like, not necessarily a tournament. It's just you versus 100 guys where one guy comes in, you got to compete against them. And there was like 5 people who had done it. And it's like the highest thing to do in Kyokushin. And it's like you just keep bringing in another guy and you've got to go against 100. And you've got to be in shape, ready to compete, and you've got to have high volume. It's like their ultimate test, if I'm remembering it correctly. Apologize if I'm wrong. Francisco Filho is one of the guys who did this test. He's one of the guys who passed it. At the time, when I was younger, I was getting the kickboxing, they said that there was only 1 of 4 or 5 people who did it. Francisco Filho was one of those people. He had this huge resume going into it. So since him, the only 3 Kyokushin guys since him, all Brazilian, him, and then there was Glauber Feitosa, who came a little bit after him, and then, of course, there was Glover Teixeira, Monster. Anyways, before Monster and his big dreads, before Glauber, the first Brazilian Kyokushin guy to really burst on the scene was Francisco Filho. Filho goes out there in his first K1 Max kickboxing. This is his first match. He got the champion in his first match, and he knocked him out cold. It is one of the craziest moments in kickboxing. It was one of the hugest upsets. It's just, you look back on it, the crowd response, because the crowd, that was Kyokushin at its highest, you know, that was Kakutugi at its highest. So everybody in Japan was like really into it, really into these kind of moments, really into these kind of fights. That KO was legit. Awesome, awesome stuff. Shout out to Francisco Filho. Don't know what he's doing now. I haven't really paid attention to him since he got that victory over Roman Bonjowski in Japan, or in Brazil, and the K1 card they did down there. But man, really huge, huge upset. Going to go ahead and go into, I guess, 2 of them. They kind of play off of each other. First, I will... I can't do that one. It's one of the bigger upsets. I'll go ahead and save that one. I will instead go David Kiria versus Andy Risti. David Kyria, this is probably the biggest comeback in a major kickboxing fight that I could think of in my mind, where the championship was on the line, and it's just, again, the fight couldn't have been more one-sided than in three rounds of pretty much dominance, plus he scored a big knee. Andy Risty came out absolutely putting it to David Kyria. Like he just, it was a clear, one-sided beatdown, and everything he threw landed. Threw a lot of kicks, a lot of step of knees, his hands. He came out there trying to, you know, destroy David Kyria. And to David Kyria's credit, held, you know, bit down in that mouthpiece, got back up when he went down, just kept holding on, just kept holding on. Next thing you know, round four, Andy Risty, who had been going for the KO for three rounds, which is what he'd been able to do when he fought three rounders, wasn't able to do it anymore. He had lost it. He'd lost the energy. He'd lost the stamina needed to really bite down and come back, you know, and keep preserve his lead. He couldn't put the foot on the gas anymore because this guy kept hanging around. And here comes David Kyria. Just started off by landing some boxing. Just started landing kicks here and there. He just kept looking for opportunities. Kept looking for opportunities. Round four ends. They go into round five. Kyria's got energy. Andy Risty does not. And Kyria is landing some big shots. And next thing you know, he lands something significant. A series of offense. And then you've got Andy Risty going down. So Andy Risty goes down. Still up on the cards at this time. He can, you know, if he can clear his head, he can get back into the fight. One of the funnier things is as soon as after it happened twice in a row, as soon as the ref allowed them back together, the first thing that Kyria did was launch a big teep at, you know, a teep-esque, you know, front kick because it was pretty mean. But he launched it at the face of Andy Risty. He did it twice in a row. Came out, threw the teep right at the face, threw some hands. Risty goes down again. That's two downs. Risty could at least salvage a draw and retain his title if he could stay on his feet. We're talking like, there is less than 30 seconds here when this is all going down. When this last moment goes down, they go back to it. Big flying teep comes at him again. Hands. He goes down. Kyria is the champion of the world for the Glory brand in Zagreb. It was really cool. One of the cooler moments. I had it in my kickboxing documentary of Kyria kind of crying after he said, you know, I'm world champion, stuff like that. David Kyria, in my personal opinion, is not even a... I picked 10 guys above him in kickboxing. But when this win happened, when this fight happened, the reason why it is such an upset is I still, to this very moment, as I said, I picked 10 guys above him, I don't look at his skill set and see a guy who is one of the best fighters in the world at any point. Like, I wouldn't have imagined it to happen. Clearly, it's a fight game, and on any given night, you can come out with that win, and you can put on that kind of performance, and David Kyria was able to do that. But because we have a tournament-based system in the history of this sport, for Kyria to get that opportunity, he'd have to win himself into that opportunity. It was only the change of Glory's outlook to try to go towards more of a mixed martial arts model where your champion defends the title and everybody beats the champion. That had to happen for Kyria to become champion. And then Kyria, he didn't even win a four-man tournament to get the opportunity. There was a four-man tournament for the championship. And David Kyria gets this opportunity, you know, despite not, you know, winning one of those or winning one of those smaller tournaments. He gets this opportunity because at the time, Risty was just fighting on a regular basis. And this was another opportunity for him. So the unlikeliness of it makes that one of the bigger upsets in the, you know, the internet era of kickboxing, and just the nature of the fight in itself makes it one of the better upsets. So shout out to Kyria, definitely good stuff there. Next, I'm going to go to Ray Sefo's victory over Jerome LeBanner by KO. To fully understand what this, you know, big KO, basically how it happens is LeBanner's out there being LeBanner, looking to land big shots over the top. Ray Sefo has the ability to throw those big shots right back. Ray Sefo comes out, lands some heat in an exchange, they throw an exchange. LeBanner backs Ray up with it, so Ray steps back, and he just stops his back foot, and he waits on LeBanner to walk right into it. He's already loaded up and delivering as LeBanner's walking forward. LeBanner tries to put offense as he walks forward, but it is too late, and Ray Sefo hits him clean. LeBanner goes out cold. Again, it happens through LeBanner's kickboxing history. He's never been known for having the best chin in the world. But at the time, he was one of the K-1 killers. Because in the 90s, the whole goal of K-1, the idea of it, is who's the strongest kickboxer on the planet. So when it first came together, Satake gets this big win in Japan, and they go, okay, this is going to be our Japanese representative. We're going to head and put this tournament team, this field together. And again, kickboxing, Kakatsugi is at its height in the 90s. So we put this guy, and we get the best fighters in the world. You know, we just some of the names off my top of my head. Was it Maurice Smith? Bronco Sikatic, Ernesto Hoost, Peter Ars was picked to be the favorite. So, like, that first field comes into play, and those first two fields were trying to get the best fighter in the world. Jerome LeBanner, Mike Bernardo, Andy Hoog, Peter Ars, those are the names that start to emerge, because outside of the tournament field, they kept giving fighters all over the world the opportunity. Right now, there's, like, a world champion in, like, every box. Back then, if you were a world champion, K-1 was going to find you and bring you in there, and you had to beat one of the guys who was beating everybody. Jerome LeBanner was one of those guys, because a lot of world champions went through K-1. Go ahead and look at some of the old K-1 cards. Don't just look at the tournaments. Look at their, one-night super fights where they just had this guy versus this guy, and you're going to see a whole lot of people show up that are world champions in some sort of form or art from somewhere, and they get absolutely slaughtered by the top people. Ray Seffo was supposed to be another one of those types of guys. He had some wins on the international circuit. He was a skilled guy, but he was in the same place as a lot of people. You got to go in there and you got to prove it against guys who are proving it over and over against world champions. These guys are killing them. Ray Seffo getting that win over LeBanner meant that he was not one of those dudes. He was here to come in and put on a performance that most people didn't even think, was possible. I mean, they thought that he had the punch and the skill set to do it, but you just didn't think that it'd be a name outside of the regulars that you were used to. Ray Seffo was one of those first guys. I would say the second generation of elite heavyweight kickboxers was Seffo, Stefan Leko, Alexei Ignashev. I'd say those guys were the second. Oh, and you could say Francisco Filho, too. Those guys were the second generation. I'd say the first generation was clearly Arts, Hoost, Bernardo, Sam Greco to a certain degree, and then, of course, Andy Hoog. Like, those guys were your first generation. The second generation are guys who came in that late 90s, and I'd say Ray Seffo's win was very much a part of that emergence. So, good stuff there. Going to go back to one of the bigger wins and all of my understanding of kickboxing, and it has to do with the word legend. The first huge, huge legend that I'd ever known about in kickboxing and Muay Thai was a guy named Samir Muhammad. And you hear that name, you're like, man, what is, that's not one of the names you thought you were going to say, Steven. He's not no guy that we know as far as the history of kickboxing. But here's Samir Muhammad was this guy who, in Muay Thai and in kickboxing, he was undefeated. So when I say he was undefeated, I'm not talking like 30-0, 40-0. Samir Muhammad had more than 100 wins. He was like 110-0. And after a while, people started to get on him. It was, guys like Kamel Jamel would be one of his bigger victories. Beat Kamel Jamel twice. People used to say that Samir Muhammad would only fight Muay Thai guys and kickboxing, waist high kickboxing. And he'd only fight waist-high kickboxing in Muay Thai. And that's kind of what happened. That's why his record started to get, ridiculous and really stretch out there. And people got on him about it. But it needs to be said, to get your hands raised more than 110 times is freaking insane. So that was one of the bigger early legends of me first getting into it. He's got a highlight. It's real old school. So if you want to look him up on YouTube, Samir Muhammad, it's a real interesting look, but you'll get to see him that he fights Muay Thai and he fights kickboxing. And as I mentioned before, Kamel Jamel, probably one of his bigger wins. Enter Samir Berbachi. Berbachi is a guy who was skilled. He was also had world championships. Everything was put into place except for he needed to beat Samir Muhammad. That was the fight that needed to happen. There's like a little kind of like, if you can find it, it's in French, but there's like this little video of him, preparing, kind of going through the fight or whatever. I don't know if it's still out there, but Samir Babechi, if I remember correctly, he beats the unbeatable Samir Muhammad when he was 116-0. So 116-0, 117-0. So when he gets his hands raised and the crowd's going crazy, you really truly did see something that no one had ever seen before. Samir Muhammad, of course, is in there like, what? What just happened? You see that look a lot. You see that look a lot where people lose and they're like, man, what was that? I thought I won and so on. But the look is a lot more significant than watching some, you know, 22-2 boxer, you know, lose to some 18-0 boxer. It's not that. It's the look of a guy who hasn't lost ever in 115 fights. Hearing someone else's name get called just must be insane. So shout out to Samir Babechi. That's probably one of the bigger upsets that you're never going to hear. Like, if you were to hear a podcast on kickboxing upsets, it's one of those that might get slipped under the radar because Samir Muhammad has a lot of waist-high kickboxing fights. And because not all of his fights were Muay Thai, not all of them were K-1 rules, he might get skipped over for that. That is not the case here. That is not fair and should not happen in this situation. This was a special fighter, and this was a special, special win by Samir Babechi. Check it out. Babechi, B-E-R-B-A-C-H-I, and then both of their names, Samir, S-A-M-I-R. I believe the whole fight's there. So, big-time upset. Shout out to, you know, those who got to see that wonderful, wonderful event happen live. Going to go ahead and go right back into it. We will go... I will save that one for last. I'll save that one for last. Stefan Leko versus Peter Arts in Las Vegas. So, of course, a lot of you guys are familiar with this. Another one of the great KOs in the history. Leko, you know, caught fire. Arts had been scoring low kicks consistently through the fights. But there's a period of time where Leko caught fire with the hands. He was scoring, hurting Peter Arts. They came together, and then there was like a moment where it was like a teep, and, you know, as Stefan Leko was trying to score, but because Arts was a little tired, he pushed himself away, and Leko also was kind of pushed away. Then the two walked towards each other, and as they're walking towards each other, it wasn't necessarily the most bodacious shot, but it was straight. All of a sudden, you see Stefan Leko just drop Peter Arts with his straight right hand, and it just puts Arts on his back. And it was awesome. Crowds into it because they're in Vegas. The first outings when they first went to Vegas, they brought their best fighters. So when Japan first brought K-1 to the USA and they went to Vegas, what it became eventually was trying to develop an American talent in the way that you look at Glory trying to develop American talent with the undercards. So that's how the fight used to be. That's how it took place. It took place with that kind of, I guess I'd call it, that was their eventual game was we need to have Americans so that we can have success in this market long term. I think that that's what their goal was. So, but that wasn't their goal originally. Their goal in the beginning was to bring the best fighters in the world because they were the best promotion in the world. So they always wanted to just have the best representation of their brand wherever they went because that's what upheld what K-1 was. So I look at that and I look at who they are and what they are and what they accomplished with that and I go, man, this really makes a lot of sense to me that these kind of athletes would, these kind of promotions would switch tact once they went to places like America. They needed to develop the talent because the talent wasn't good enough. Carter Williams came a little bit later. But in the beginning, us Americans, just like when we watch Glory now, we want to see the best fighters in the world. We'll take some Americans. We'll take a couple fights. But really, we want to see the best fighters in the world. It's so easy for me to say that because I'm a kickboxing fan. But having witnessed some of the Glory crowds in the USA, you know, I've been to like three or four of their events now. And it's clear that it's important to them to have some undercard fights. They gotta have that. So they got to have some local guys as well. So in the beginning, got myself off track because it's kickboxing. I got into side tangent. But in the beginning, we've got Glory at its height. We got K-1 at its height going to Japan, bringing their best stars over. Leko at the time, his step-up bouts were Jorgen Kruth, Jerome LeBanner, Francisco Filho, Sam Greco, Ernesto Hoost. He had lost them all. Lecco had lost all of his step-up bouts. He fought guys that he could be like Harry Hooftar, Henry Hooft, as we call him here in the States. He'd beaten guys like that. You know, he'd beaten guys who were, you know, of his level at the time. You know, he had beaten guys who had good resumes. But his first real step-up bout didn't come until later in his life. It didn't come until... his first real step-up victory didn't come until 3 or 4 years into his K-1 run and his kickboxing run at the top. So when this victory happened, Arts was still he's still a 3-time K-1, champion. He was still a guy who was winning with low kicks, winning with high kicks, winning with boxing. And deceptively, he's got a lot of knee KOs. Most people don't know that. Peter Arts has got a lot of KOs with his knees. So this was a big-time victory. Definitely shout out to, Stefan Lecco. That was the one that really put him on the map. After this, he had some pretty solid runs. It should be noted that he'd beaten Ignashov twice. His volume was really kind of like a style that worked against him. So I can't say that he was without a significant, win. But Ignashov was in the same boat as he was. At the time, Ignashov was his up-and-comer that people didn't know a lot about. So big-time win for Stefan Lecco. Going to go ahead and stay in the kickboxing heavyweight division. We are going to go with Badr Hari and Peter Graham. Now, again, I'm going to have to save it as far as controversies and all that for later. But the victory in itself, Badr Hari was still an unproven kickboxer, but he had all the buzz in the world, and he had the win over Lecco. He was better than Peter Graham, who everybody felt like they knew. Peter Graham had one opportunity. He got into the K1 Max. I want to say an injury replacement. He gets in there and he gets Remy Bonjowski, and he's absolutely blown out of the water. And when he went against elite guys, Peter Graham, again, lost to Mark Hunt. He lost to guys who had names. He was a guy who, they had the big, press conference, scuffle, and, they had everything. He's getting whooped for 3 rounds. He is absolutely not winning the fight. He might score here and there, but he's not winning this fight, all right? So when this happens with, 12 seconds left in the fight, when he jumps in the air and does that, oh, my gosh, it's just... To just see that kick, to see the Rolling Thunder score in that way, where he does the jump spinning, almost kind of like, flippish spin type kick. But it landed so clean on Badr Hari, who had talked trash. And it's definitely, go listen to the commentary, because that also builds it, because Mike Chevelle's on commentary. But the kick landed so clean, and he was gone. Badr Hari wasn't just gone, but he had to have his jaw rewired, and it was just, he went on to have a great career considering. So if you want to know how to bounce back from bad KOs and so on, Badr Hari's been on both ends. He has a bad spinning kick, to Stefan Lecco for victory, and then he's got a bad, Rolling Thunder kick that he ate on his own. So Peter Graham getting that victory. He never recaptured a moment in kickboxing. He got stopped in the next round of that tournament. But he never recaptured a moment like that for the rest of his career. Badr Hari won the rematch, and Badr Hari won a KO stoppage in Dubai, down the road. But, man, that one day, that one moment, that's kind of what makes upsets what they are. It's when something happens that you weren't expecting. It's when something, when you look at it and you go, on paper, this is not supposed to be, and it is. So, shout out to Peter Graham for that moment. Next fight I'm going to talk about. Andy Sauer gets a, surprising loss to Spanish Fire, Abraham Aquini. This is an interesting fight because when I was sitting down and I was thinking about the controversy that I mentioned before, because there is a little bit of controversy with this fight. But you can make the argument that on the rules, Abraham Aquini rightfully won this fight. So I am fine with it. I definitely liked Sauer's total work, but for sure, I can see Abraham Aquini getting a win. Now, again, down the road on the scorecards, Spain is going to be known. Spain and Italy are known for having some questionable scorecards in favor of some of their better fighters. But this night, I got to give Abraham Aquini his due. Goes out there. At the time, Andy Sauer had, come off of, some decent wins in his life. He had Already been K-1 champion twice. He had already been shootboxing champion. And at that period of time, he'd lost to Ogata, who, you know, kind of emerged to win the shootboxing champion that year. It was a kind of a surprise. Most people didn't have that. Everybody thought that Sauer would win it until he stopped. And then there was another fight in there that I can't remember. But at the time, Requini was this up-and-coming dude looking for his, you know, step-up bout. He's looking for the bout that was going to put him on the map. He found it. Andy Sauer took a fight in his, I won't say it's necessarily his hometown, but in Spain. Goes out there, he comes out on fire. He really did go after Andy Sauer early, and Andy can have some slow starts. And he starts building on the offense, he starts building on his work. Next thing you know, a lot of people have him up after one round. Then, in the first 10 seconds of round two, Andy Sauer is throwing a low kick, Abraham Requini is throwing a right hand, and he scores. Andy Sauer falls on his butt. I do not think it should have been called a down, but in my personal opinion, you've heard me say it on this podcast show a lot, there is nothing, and I mean nothing, harder for judges to try to figure out than determining what is an actual down when a person is kicking, when they get hit. Because sometimes it's legitimately a slip, and sometimes they are legitimately hurt. I was rewatching fights the other day, and Tyrone Spong landed a kind of jab hook, you know, S variation, but he scored it right as Carnage Corbett threw a low kick. But when Carnage went down, you could see that Carnage was hurt from the shot. Ref called it correctly there. This is one of those situations where Sauer was up so quick, it looked like it was fine. It looked like it shouldn't have happened. But they went ahead, they did their job, they called it a down, which means mathematically, Andy Sauer's got to do some work to get himself back in this fight. Andy Sauer turns it on at the end of the round. They probably still went 10-8. In a guy's hometown, it's really rare that somebody can overturn a 10, you know, a 10-8 and make it a 9-8 round or whatever they want to call it. It's rare that that happens. So anyways, he's up on the fight. Round three is just Sauer beating the life out of Abraham Requini. He's landing everything. Requini is done. He's just trying to survive. He can get the scorecards. He can win. The controversy in this fight happens where I think it's because of blood. They stop it with like 40 seconds left. And you can make the argument that Sauer was going to finish the fight off before it because Requini had just been taking so many shots. Nevertheless, Requini comes out. He's got the energy to go the distance. I think he throws a few shots. But at the time, Requini was a nobody, and he became a somebody. That win, he built on it. He then went on to beat Drago. Again, Gago Drago was starting to turn the page a little bit. He wasn't what he was when he first burst on the scene as, you know, the super prospect that he used to be. But he turned it around. He had an okay career, you know, got to fight all over the world. Never used in some of the major tournaments. Sauer would avenge the loss later on. But at the time, that was the big win for Abraham Requini. And again, upset is something that you don't see coming. And when this fight was put together, I thought that Andy Sauer was going to go beat up some guy in Spain. But it did not go that way. Abraham Requini on my list for one of the upsets. Next one I'm going to talk about is someone that you guys are all familiar with. I'll talk about two. First, I'll talk about the, I'll save my two biggest upsets for last. This one was just an upset just because if you knew something about the history of kickboxing and its time, it really is... Well, I'll save it. I'll go with this one instead. Hinata got a victory over Artur Kashingo back in the day. Body kick stoppage. And I bring it up because, first of all, it didn't happen in a major promotion. It happened in a solid promotion. I believe it was Crush. It might have even been... Rise. I can't remember exactly 100%, but it didn't happen in K1. But basically what happened was he looked super drained in the first place. So a lot of it took place on the scale. But at the time, Artur Kashingo was still considered one of the best fighters in the world. He had, if you want to look at the evolution of a fighter, there are a few guys who have changed their style as much over their career as Artur Kashingo has changed his style. In the beginning, he was this guy who he could throw any shot. He threw a lot of combinations, combination high kick, combination low kick. He could win with low kicks. He had one of the meanest body shots in the game. And he had this really tricky sweep thing that he used to do that was Thai style, but he'd do it in kickboxing matches. They didn't go too crazy on him for it, but he got away with a lot of stuff. Here is a guy who had, you know, he lost to Masato, and in the second fight in the K-1 World Grand Prix, it looked like he had probably won that fight, but it didn't go his way. He was already picking up his name as one of the best in the world. Hinata was a guy who had the skill set to be a legitimate kickboxer at the top of the world. No one looked at Hinata and said world champion, but they did look at him and say, this guy's going to do something one day. This guy has the potential. Hinata was able to put together victories over Mike Zambides, but I'd say his most important victory early in his life was a victory over Artur Kashchenko. He wasn't able to build on it, but I'm telling you, what I was saying about his body kick and how sharp it suits up from the ground and goes straight to the target, it scored and Kashchenko went down. And to that point, Kashchenko was durable. I mean, he had some KO losses over his career, but he was a durable dude, and outside of the counter shot that he took against Masato in the second round, he hadn't really been stopped, and he'd been beating a lot of guys. He'd been fighting on his Showtime. He'd been fighting in K1. He'd been fighting the best. So when the loss happened, it wasn't like he lost a bad decision on a small promotion in Japan. He got stopped by an up-and-coming Japanese fighter who wasn't able to quite build on it, which is why I look at it and I go, that's why it's an upset. He wasn't able to turn himself into an elite fighter. Since that loss, Artur Kashchenko went on to have a Hall of Fame-esque career if we had a Hall of Fame. He went on to beat so many elite guys even after that moment. But in that moment, cutting down to that weight, that was Hinata's night, and definitely a KO I will remember. So we go back into the list. I'm down to my last few, and I've got a couple of really, really fun ones. Musashi beats Peter Arts. K-1 World Grand Prix, first one I ever watched, is 2003 when Remy Majowski wins his first title. And he wins, of course, over Musashi. People don't understand that if you go ahead and go to Musashi's kickboxing, Wikipedia, and look at his fights, this dude got slaughtered. This guy was thrown to the wolves right away. And I remember talking about it with Duke Rufus once. And we were both talking about what happened to Musashi's career. And he goes, man, I think Musashi's awesome because that guy was thrown to the wolves. Because they were looking for a Japanese star to compete with the best in the world, they kept giving any Japanese heavyweight opportunities on TV. The only problem was they were going against guys who were way better than them. Musashi was probably the worst victim of that. First of all, he wasn't even a heavyweight when he first got in. Like, he probably weighed 180 pounds. Like, he was not a big guy at all. He grew into a bigger body over time. But in the beginning, you've got all these KO losses to Hoost I pretty much just name a fighter, and he's got a KO over him. But Hoost, I want to say Arts got him too before this, got a KO over him. Of course, Mirko, the elite guys would go against him and knock him out. Not just beat him, knock him out. He'd have a fight where he'd win here and there. He got a draw with Sataki. Every once in a while, they'd throw him somebody easy. But in the beginning, he just got all these just wolves. So, goes into the tournament field. And again, it's a tournament, so anything could happen in a tournament. His first round opponent in that tournament is Ray Seffel. And Ray Seffel is a little bit sick, but Ray's going to come out and compete. It happened to Ray a few times, actually, over throughout the 90s, where he came in sick, but he competed anyways. Ray comes in sick, looks to score some effective offense. It's not to be. He's out-kickboxed, clearly, by the healthy Musashi. Peter Arts comes in, and he's in a more grueling-than-expected fight with that I felt he clearly won after three rounds, but it goes to an extra with Alexei Igonashov. So then he goes in. Both guys, one guy fought four rounds, one guy fought three. And it just was like one of those fights where, like, the stars aligned. Everything that Musashi used to get hit by, he didn't get hit by in this night. He didn't get hit by a lot of low kicks. He stayed in the southpaw stance. He didn't get hit by big offense. And then all of a sudden, subtle movement, stepping to the side, not engaging as much, not putting himself at risk, a bigger body, because now he'd been in K1 for like seven years by the time this fight happened. And then Arts, who had used a little bit more energy than he'd hoped against Igonashov, looking for shots, just didn't come together. Then all of a sudden you see a clean hand score. Then you see a follow-up body kick. Then you see movement, and you see, oh my goodness, on the cards, Musashi's looking like he's going to get this. Musashi gets the win. He then goes on, of course, to lose the next round to Remy Bunjowski. They did continue to use Musashi as a star. They wanted him to win the championship. A lot of people will point out the questionable judging in the next year when he went against Remy Bunjowski in the final. A lot of people look at, you know, on that road to that, he beat Cepho again, and then he beat Gogolai Ganorison because Gogolai had that big, crazy upset, you know, kick. But they pushed Musashi for a little bit. He wasn't able to be the star that they wanted to. He wasn't able to win the championship. I remember they used to start calling him the battleship. They were doing a lot of things to kind of make him happy, but it didn't happen for him. To his credit, there was always that special night where he was able to beat Rey Cepho, but he was sick, so I couldn't put that on this list. But I could put the Peter Arts one of the list. Shout out to Musashi, because if you look at Musashi's fights in the late 90s, I'm telling you, this guy was smashed. He was just absolutely KO'd every single time. Shout out to Musashi for making this moment happen. We are down to the last three on my list. Bukau versus Masato. Now, you hear this and you go, okay, wait a minute, Bukau's one of the greats. One of the greats ever. In the beginning, he was not one of the greats. You wouldn't understand it until you saw it. But in the beginning, he was first of all, people should really, really do their history on Bukau, and they should really look at kind of where he emerged from and, excuse me, my apologies, where he emerged from and his history. It really gives you a better understanding of just how crazy a story that he is. And, you know, you got to give him his due for what he ended up, you know, accomplishing overall in his career. And if you, you know, go to his Wikipedia, you're going to see a lot of stretches of green because he was beating a lot of guys. But basically, the story of him is he gets into Lumpini. So he wins all of his regional. He gets into Lumpini. And he has an okay run, but not great run. You know, it wasn't a huge, you know, like he had a lot of losses when he fought in Lumpini. He had some wins here and there, but really his Lumpini run wasn't great. So the thing that changed it around for him was he got into something called the King of Martial Arts. And in that fight, he goes against a guy named Timur Dale. And I believe Timur, he's either from Australia. I believe he is from New Zealand. He beats Dale, and then all of a sudden, after there's a really famous video of him after he gets the victory, where he's like doing this, like between rounds one and two, there's a ring girl who comes in and she's like holding the card, and he goes up and he starts dancing with her. So he shows this charisma that you'd never really seen from the Thais. Thais were really kind of straightforward at that time, very, very skilled guys and so on, but very straightforward. So he comes out and he shows this charisma, and you're like, okay, this guy's a little bit different. Get some other wins in the international scene. Sun Tao is one that, if I'm remembering correctly, in China. I should really bring this up. Fuji Chomsek is another guy who he beat. I want to say that happened. Oh, man. I'm trying to remember what that card was called. Magnum 4, I want to say it was. I bet you I got that right. But that's another one of those guys. And then he gets an opportunity to fight Jordan Tai to get into the K1. K1 Max, he gets that victory, and then he moves in to the tournament field. In this tournament field, he beats Jian Wei Par in a extra round split decision, very close fight there. He then bowls out Takayuki Kohiromaki, and then he gets the opportunity with Masato. Now, before I talk about this, we got to talk about Masato. Masato, the Silver Wolf, was the golden child for the brand. He was very, very much a superstar because not only was he a skilled fighter who had the potential to be the best in the world, he also had the look. He had the girls loved him. He was built for TV. He modeled. He did so many commercials. He was a huge star. Huge star for the promotion. So clearly, if they have their way, he's going to win the K1 Max for the next 6 years. Such a huge star. And so good with his money that he was able to retire early. He came back and did an exhibition fight with Kid Yamamoto. But overall, I look at his life and I go, man, this guy really was able to get out of this sport game pretty early because he was that good with his money. All Japan Kickboxing was the organization where he was able to build his identity. Got a lot of wins there. Had some undercard fights for K1. I remember they would have like a whole heavyweight kickboxing, you know, card, and then he'd fight like a Murad Sari or something like that, like on the undercard. So he was getting those opportunities. I want to say, I'd have to look it up. I believe it was his fight with Erickson, Patrick Erickson. I believe that was on a K1 card in 2001. And in that card, he was able to get a victory on the undercard, like of a major, major kickboxing card. Noel Soares, I'm going to go ahead and look it up now. Noel Soares is another one. I believe that was also on a kickboxing for the heavyweights card that they just threw that fight on there. To that moment, you know, he had come out and he had these opportunities to fight for, you know, K1 and their brand. And the Thais that were brought in to fight were older Thais who just, they were names, but they weren't guys who you were expecting to be champions for a long time. They were guys who were, you know, legitimate Thais, but in no way would you be like, oh, okay, I know that guy. But they weren't those kind of Thais. So one of the guys was a guy named Sekadao Kiat Putan. Nothing special or splashy about him. He was a solid fighter, a good fighter, but, you know, he was stopped with an uppercut in that fight. But, I mean, it just kind of goes to show that was the kind of Thai that they brought in before. Enter Bukau, who has all this charisma. He's a different type of dude. He then goes out there and smashes Masato. It'd be one thing if he went out there and the fight was competitive and he pulled off this upset. The reason why this was such a big, you know, being pulled off this upset against a name, a guy that we knew, but it wasn't like he beat him and, you know, the cards were closed and we were like, you know, on the edge of our seats or whatever. This was a wipeout. He smashed Masato, and that's what made it such an upset. It wasn't that he won, it was how he won. Absolute blowout. Shout out to him for that big win, because afterwards, Bukau became Bukau. You know, his next fight was with Koza Takada. It went to an extra round, but he dropped Koza twice in that extra round. Went on to win another K-1 World Grand Prix. Went on to win a Shoeboxing Championship. Went on to tie fight. Went on to be Bukau. But it all started with that special night where he got his opportunity to fight in the K-1 Max. And not only did he won over the crowd. Absolutely brutal. He smashed from the saddle for 3 rounds. The cards somehow scored 1 for Bukau and 2 called it every round a draw. So then it was one of those weird, just rewatch the fight and look at Masato's face where it's like, I got to go back out there with this guy. It clearly wasn't his night, but it was almost like on the cards, maybe they were told in the back, if it's close, it's a draw. If the other guy looks like he's winning, but not by a wide margin, it's a draw. That's how people felt when they watched Masato's destruction, because the Musashi-Bojowski decision was really, really close to that. Like, it seemed like there was a period of time where the Japan cards were favoring cards, are not so much that they were making their guys win, but they are making sure that their guys had the opportunity to keep fighting and get the win later if they didn't have it in the bag at that period of time. So that has to come into play. But Bukau became Bukau when he got a one-sided beatdown of 4 rounds over, you know, the overmatched Masato on that night. Masato, of course, would come back and avenge the loss. But good stuff there. We now move on to the last two. These are the last, I would say these two are the biggest. There are some upsets that are not mentioned, but these two, because of how they happened, are pretty, pretty significant. Bukau versus Yoshihiro Sato. And Yoshihiro Sato gets the KO victory over Bukau. This one was almost my number one because, again, at this point, Bukau had beaten Sato twice. He had blew him out in the tournament. He got a super fight victory over him in an extra round where Bukau was absolutely smashing Yoshihiro Sato, and then Sato landed a big shot in like the last 5 seconds. Bukau was fine after the shot, but it was a big shot. I mean, it looked like it dazed him for a second, and one of the cards actually went to Sato because of that big shot, but the other two saw that Bukau had clearly dominated, you know, the other 3 minutes and 40 seconds, or 2 minutes and 45 seconds of the fight. So that led into this opportunity to happen in the K1 Max field. And I want to say it was in their final 8, You know, because they had broken the tournament up. It used to be an 8-man tournament one night, and then turned into two cards that had elimination, 8-man tournament, and then the final four was done in one night. A lot of people felt that was done because of Masato, because they felt Masato's body couldn't hold up anymore, and they switched the field in favor of him. A lot of people felt that way. But, man, it needs to be said that this fight, which was decently competitive, there was some good back and forth. Bukau had his moments. And then all of a sudden, Bukau takes a shot, and his body's, like, out without going down. Like he's just, he hadn't fallen. There hadn't been a bigger shot to build on it. But then he kind of freezes up, and he just kind of tips over, and it goes down. And then he does not make the count, and Sato wins. After the fight happened, I'm telling you, there were so many dive calls, you have no idea. So many people were like, he was told by Mr. Pamuk to take a dive. He's never been stopped. Bukau had never been stopped in his life. 300 fights or however many it is, he had never been stopped. And then all of a sudden he goes down to Yoshihiro Sato, who is not known for stopping people with his hands. So as you can understand, at the time, there was so much merit behind the idea that maybe Bukau, upset about contract because he didn't really fight for their brand much after that. There were so many people who thought that this was a dive because he was upset about money and that they just used all their money and bet against Bukau, and then Bukau took a dive. It's that controversy that made it such an upset. But Sato went about his work and went on to have a decent tournament run, but this KO, I mean, go ahead and rewatch it for yourself. It's the third fight between Bukau and Yoshihiro Sato. You let me know. You can tweet at me what you feel and so on, but I'm telling you, at the time, it was a huge upset. It was not, no one saw it coming. No one saw a victory by Sato, wouldn't bother people that much. A KO victory by Sato had people wondering. So that is why that is my number two of, I didn't have the other ones ranked, but I definitely say in the internet era, that's the number two upset. The number one upset to me is clear, and it's clear by a landslide. Andy Risty KOs Georgia Petrosian and Robin Van Roosmalen in one night. This, I'm going to go ahead and kind of set this up by kind of telling you guys what was going on before this whole breakdown. So we're going to go ahead and go against Andy Risty. I am going to have a show where I talk about the most dominant stretches in kickboxing. It should be noted that this happened much later. Risty started kickboxing later in his career. I believe he was like 27, that he got into it. So this whole time where he was like K-1 champion and stuff like that, he'd been glory champion. He'd been like 33 years old, 34 years old. He was not a young up-and-coming fighter. I remember I saw somebody post, you know, MMA guys get into kickboxing. I remember one of the writers posted that he was a young prospect. I was like, he's not a young prospect. He looks young, but this guy started older. And he still got KO power, still a mean guy, but it needs to be said, he was not young. So I want you to get a better grip on just what we're talking about that led into this. So I will go ahead and start with 2011. He goes against Nick Bayards and he KOs him. Gets a decision over William Diener. Risco. This happens on the It's Showtime, because at the time, It's Showtime was the brand, because K1 was down, Glory was just getting started. He goes out there, KO stoppage over Risco, KO stoppage over Hinata, goes to a decision with Drago, but gets the victory. He hurt Drago several times in the fight, but Drago, tough dude, tough dude, but he gets the victory over Drago. That was in K1 Max when they brought it back. KO victory over Samir Ajaba. KO victory over David Calvo. KO victory over Norden Benoit. That Norden Benoit. KO victory over Hinata Watanabe. Then he gets a loss. Now again, I just took you from 2011 to 2012. There was one decision. There was two decisions, and then there was seven stoppages, if I'm remembering correctly. Okay, he gets the close fight loss to Andy Sauer, and then he gets a victory over Alessandro Campagna. That was one of those fights where afterwards people are like, I'm not sure about Risty. I'm not sure if Risty has what it takes to be one of the best in the world. Then he stops Albert Krauss, and one of the cooler step-up knees you're ever going to see are step knees. But then he gets a victory over Nicholas Larson. And after this victory, he says, and he was saying it, you know, all summer, I want to fight Georgia Petrosian. I'm going to knock him out. Everybody was hearing this, and they're like, this dude has lost his damn mind. You are not going to knock out a guy who doesn't get knocked out, who's got one of the best defensive – his vision, his fast twitch muscles, his ability to read and get out of the way of punches. We're talking about one of the all-time greats in Georgia Petrosian. Not just resume-wise, but skill set-wise. Guys who were born with the tools to be special in kickboxing. You're talking about Georgia Petrosian. And Andy Risty, who had the Alessandro Campagna fight that didn't look that great, the Nicholas Larson fight, which was a victory, again, not always looking at his best. You hear that and you go, okay, this guy is he's lost it. I don't know what's going through his head, but he ain't going to go out there and beat Georgia Petrosian. He draws Georgia Petrosian in first round of that four-man tournament, and he knocks Georgia Petrosian out. Georgia Petrosian was up in the carts. He had been scoring more clean offense, but he wasn't the only one scoring. When he was winning that fight, he still was taking some significant shots from Andy Risty. And the shot that put him away was actually, most people missed it. It was like a short uppercut that really, really hurt. And again, of course, everybody knows about Petrosian's hand. But he had hurt him with the uppercut bad. And the follow-up punch had missed as Georgia Petrosian was going down. But Giorgio was done. It was that type of big-time sharp shot, and a lot of people didn't see it. It's 43 seconds into round three. All of a sudden, the unbeatable isn't just beaten. He is knocked out. Then Robin van Roosmalen comes in after winning his earlier tournament. I believe he went against Devik Kiria, if I remember correctly, in that four-man tournament. So he goes against him, and then he does it again. He dropped Robin van Roosmalen in the first round, and then he knocked him out with an uppercut in the second round. That one-night tournament over those names, in particular Georgia Petrosian, that was the biggest upset in the history of me watching kickboxing. That night, I'm telling you, Petrosian was seen as that much more superior over a inconsistent Andy Risty, who is known more for having power, offense, and spots. And it kind of adds to why the Devik Kiria victory was so significant. And that's why I mentioned it earlier on the show. Because Andy Risty, his next fight after Robin van Roosmalen, was the Devik Kiria. So I look at that. I look at these upsets. And again, you guys have your own. Go ahead. Tweet me some of your own that you guys have, some that you think that I missed and that kind of deal, whatever. I'll go ahead and wrap this show up. It's a little bit longer. But those are the most significant kickboxing victories. Some Muay Thai, but most of those were just the big, big upsets that, you know, not significant victories, but upsets. But those were the ones that really, really took the world when they happen. So shout out to Andy Risty for pulling off the biggest upset that I know of. So go ahead and wrap up the show. Next week, I'm thinking I'll probably do a podcast on like Friday. I am leaning towards, really, really leaning towards my next week episode being about the super prospect, the one that everybody was talking about. I want to talk about the elite guys who accomplished that, who went on from – you had to accomplish something. You couldn't just be a super prospect. So I'll either do that or I'll do the best that never was. Guys who had that potential, but it just didn't turn out, whether it was management, whether it was opportunities. But guys who had that skill set, but they didn't get the chance. So those are the ones that I'll talk about. So go ahead and see you guys next week. Thank you so much. God bless and have a good one. Peace.